Shalom, dear listeners. It's a bright and crisp Thursday morning and close, and the clock says it's 11 a.m. Indian Standard Time, and all of that means it's time for Radio Sai Answering Booth. I don't know if I can say it's your favorite show, but certainly my favorite show, because in this show, I have the opportunity to explore Swami's message deeply along with all of you, and most importantly, in the light of some practical obstacles we tend to face in life. This week too, we have a question which is a practical doubt one of the listeners happened to face in the course of her spiritual endeavors. By the way, I'm Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and let's begin by offering our humble pranams at Swami's lotus feet. All right then, let's begin this week's show with a quote of the week. Yesterday was Buddha Purnima, and the festivities continue today too. So it would be appropriate to have a quote from Buddhism, isn't it? But the lines I'm going to read are general quotes from Buddhism. Some may be from Gautama Buddha's own words, some others may be words of other sages of the Buddhist tradition. So here comes the quote of the week. We ourselves must walk the path. Holding on to anger is like grasping a hot coal with the intent of throwing it at someone else. You are the one to get hurt and burned. A man is not called wise because he talks and talks again. But he is peaceful, loving and fearless. Then he is in truth called wise. End of quote. As you can see, that's a collection of quotes. The first one says that it is we who have to walk the path. Like other things we get through inheritance, maybe like looks, wealth, maybe even culture. The spiritual path has to be walked by each of us all alone. We could have the best guru in the form of God himself, but yet the path has to be walked by us. The next one is a profound thought, interestingly put, to show that anger hurts the person who expresses it as much, if not more, than the person who is the target. It says it's like picking up hot coal to throw at someone. Your hands will be the first to burn. Maybe the other person may even evade your throw if he or she is wise enough, but you would be hurt either ways, right? Worse is the case of carrying anger with the idea of hurling it at someone when the opportunity arises. That is even more dangerous to oneself because you're going to be carrying around that hot coal always with you. Final lines speak how you can never be wise based on what you speak or express, but you are wise only if you are that knowledge itself. In other words, only if that knowledge has become so much a part of you that you would come across as a peaceful, loving and fearless person, only then you're truly wise. Wow, what a combination of qualities. Peace, love and fearlessness. What is the worth of all spirituality if it does not give us these qualities? Maybe that's the best way to assess our spiritual progress. Well, just hold on to that thought, for I'm having a feeling we'll come back to that idea during our answer. But for now, permit me to read one more time that collection of quotes from Buddhism. We ourselves must walk the path. Holding on to anger is like grasping a hot coal with the intent of throwing it at someone else. You are the one who gets burned. A man is not called wise because he talks and talks again. But if he is peaceful, loving and fearless, then he is in truth called wise. All right then, it's time to head to the question of the week. As I said, it's from a devotee who wishes to be anonymous, but it's a lady and she's written to us about a problem she faces in her spiritual path. I have Sister Sumana, a volunteer, who's read out the question for us. So I'll play out the question in Sister Sumana's voice. And after that, let's see what answer we can come up for this person.
Sai Ram, I'm a Swami's devotee since last 20 years. And I used to feel Swami is my everything and could relate with Swami as God. But recently, I came across one study group where I came to know that true God is Paramatma, that is, a form of light. While any divine being who has birth and death are not God, but they are messengers of God or pure souls or gurus. We should pray to only the formless God as a point of light rather than gurus. When I meditate now, I don't see Swami, but just a point of light. I am confused if I am doing right. It is very scary because when I listen to bhajans nowadays, I don't feel connected to that. I feel all Rama, Krishna and Swami are gurus and I should focus more on the light. I am not sure if this is spiritual progress to meditate from form to formless, or it is mere confusion, or my spiritual decline.
So that's the question, and I think that's the doubt she has expressed to us, whether what she's undergoing is a spiritual progress or a decline, or is it wrong to think that way? Is it right to meditate upon God as a form of light? So a lot of questions there. Well, to start with, you know, what question was posed to us through that listener, I think it has two distinct parts to it, and we'll have to address both of them separately. And in fact, that is a confusion that we most often, you know, get into. The first thing is the point of what is the nature of God himself? Is it possible that God can come in a human form? Does God have a form, or is God like light? That is one thing. What is the nature of God himself is one query. The other thing is, what is the way I need to worship him? What is the way I need to picturize him when I am meditating upon him? Or are there levels of progress in this effort that I take to worship him? If I think of him as a form, is it that it's a lower level? If I think of him as formless, is it that of a higher level? So these are two distinct issues. What is God really? What is his nature? And the second thing is, how do I picturize him, or how do I worship him? Do I see him as light, or do I see him as one with form? So to start with, I think I'll start with what we should do. I think that's of more importance to us and practical relevance to us, because as you would see, the analysis of what God is a very, very vast and debatable topic. I'll try to briefly talk about that after I speak about the practical part of the question, as I said. But the fact is, at the end of it, none of us can comprehend the true nature of God, as we'll come to that. So the question is, so can you meditate on light or visualize light when you sing bhajans and so on? Let's take that pointed question. Is it all right if I'm meditating upon light or a point of light when I'm doing meditation or bhajans? Of course you can. Well, the reason is, God is as much light as he is any other form. There is no difference. And putting it in other words, I would say it is as much an inaccuracy to think of God as light as it is to think of God as a human form. Well, what I said might be contradictory, but that is what it really is. Then how is it wrong, and how is it all right to think of light, God as light? No, because the worship is never about accuracy at all. When we talk about meditation, when we talk about worship, it's never about how accurately we are picturizing God in our mind. That is not what worship is meant to be about, right? The reason is, as I said, we don't have really the ability to comprehend the truth or the real nature of God. So when that is the case, none of the processes that we undertake as form of worship need to be accurate at all. You know, in the Vedas, there is this appellation for God. I happened to talk about this as in a reply to a previous question too. It's a beautiful name. God is referred to as Aprameya. Right? And this means that he cannot be known through the human tools of knowing. That is what the meaning of that word Aprameya means. So what are the tools that we have within the human capacity to know anything? Forget about God, the nature of the world, the nature of objects in front of us, to understand our own selves. What are the tools of knowing that we have? One thing is, we have the sense organs, your eyes, your ears, and you know, your organs of perception. And any tool of knowledge, in Sanskrit, the word for that is pramana, right? Pramana is the word which is used for a tool of knowledge. And when the knowing is through direct perception, either by seeing or feeling with your hands, or listening directly, or you're sensing it through your senses, That is called Pratyaksha Pramana. The direct tool of knowledge is called Pratyaksha Pramana. And the other is, there are many other pramanas, Anumana Pramana, and Apalabdhi Pramana or something like that. And many types of pramana, which is nothing but using your intellectual power to extend or extrapolate or derive at something which you do not see directly, which you do not perceive directly. You come to conclusions. The typical example which Swami would give is, when you see a smoke somewhere, you know there is a fire. When you see a lot of cranes sitting on a tree, you know there's a water body nearby. You don't see the event directly, but you infer that this must be the case, right? So all things that we understand in life, all the things that we investigate and come to know of, falls under the ability to either see or perceive directly, or our ability to understand it through derivations and through, you know, extensions of our intellectual abilities. So now, what does the Veda say? The Veda say that he is beyond any of these capacities. But what do I mean by saying that you use these tools to talk about God? Let's say now you talk of the form of Vishnu, right? So Vishnu has a form like this. He's a human form. And why do we give him a human form? Because we have seen a human form. So we extend it and say that it's a very, very beautiful and attractive human form. So from a human form, we make it a superhuman form by saying, no, he does not have two hands, but he has four hands. He does not have one head, but he has three heads, six heads, whatever it is. So what we are doing is, we are giving a form to God, which is a combination of these tools of knowledge, of perception, and of intellectual abilities. We combine these two, and we create a form for the Lord, right? And we try to make it as complex as we can. As we say Brahma has four heads, and we talk of Vishwarupa, which has got multiple heads and an elaborate form. All of these is extension of what we already know, combined with our imagination and our intellectual extensions, right? So whatever it is, when I say God is a point of light, what am I doing here? You know, I have seen light before. And so I imagine a very, very bright light compared to the light I've already seen. And that light, usually any form of light that we see has a source, has a power source. So when you talk of God as light, we talk of him as self-luminescent. He does not need to draw power from anywhere, but he is self-luminescent. Alright, so that is a attribute we give to this light. And then we say that it is very, very bright. It's equal to, it's more brighter than anything that I've seen. So again, what are we trying to do is, we are actually taking something which we have seen already, and then we are extending it through our imaginations and intellectual abilities. And that is why there are these many names. For instance, what is that light that we know of, which is self-luminescent and very bright? The only source of light that we know of that order is the sun. So we have seen the sun. So now when we have to describe God, we describe God based on what we've already seen. So what do we say? The Vedas say, Aditya Varnam Tamasav Parastat. They say God is of the hue of the sun, because sun is the only bright object that I know. So it says, Aditya Varnam Tamasav Parastat. It's beyond darkness and it is bright like the sun. Or we say that, you know, we use a hyperbole. We say Surya Koti Samaprabha. He's not of the brilliance of one sun, but he has the brilliance of 100 million suns. Surya Koti Samaprabha, we say. Or we say, you know, Shatas Sahasra Surya Prakasha. We say that he has the brilliance of hundreds of thousands of suns. So in all of these cases, be it the case of Lord Vishnu with the different limbs that we attach to him, or this idea of God as light, is nothing but a combination of what we have already seen, which is Pratyaksha Pramana, and we add to it our intellectual abilities in the form of our imaginations and our derivations, and we make this form superhuman, and we say that, you know, if we talk of him as a human form, we talk of him as a superhuman form. If we talk of him as light, we talk of him as the super light, which is incomparable to what we've already seen. So you see, this is as much an imagination as seeing a form, relating a form to God, right? And the Vedas say that God is apramaya. He is beyond your ability to imagine also, right? That's what the Vedas say. So in both of these cases, every form that you imagine, light, a human form, a form of an animal if you want, or any of those things, you can imagine any form, you are inaccurate in your understanding of God. So in that case, thinking of God as a point of light is necessarily not as a progression as over thinking of God as a form. Because I hope you understand that basically both of these are extensions of our imagination, and the Vedas say that you cannot imagine God, and whatever you imagine, He's beyond that. And we always have this idea that when we talk of God as formless, we invariably put the idea of Him being luminescent in the form of a light. Look at it from the point of view of a painter, right? If a painter is drawing a picture of God and he tells you that I'd like to, you know, paint a picture of God, and he asks you, give me your image of God. So you tell him that, you know, he's like this, he has a very masculine human body, and he has a bow in his hand, he has a crown on his head. You give him the description, he puts it on canvas. If another person comes and says, my idea of God is, you know, he is this huge ball of light, and the light is spreading all across, and it's yellow in color, or it's golden rays, or whatever it is, he again puts it on canvas. So from the point of view of the painter, both of these are paintings. One thinks that God has a form, the other thinks God is formless, so he's bright like light. But from the point of view of the painter, both of these are paintings. He has put it on paper. So in that sense, from the point of view of the painter, both are equally forms. So we forget this idea that even when I sit and meditate of God as a form of light, it is a form. It is not the absolute or formless, right? So then the question comes, why do we need to think of a form? Why do we need to represent Him as a form at all? You know, let us take this example. Let's say that you have a 10-year-old son and you're trying to make him study. You want to make him sit down and study. But this child is very mischievous. He's running all around the place. He's running into the kitchen. He's running into the bedroom. He's running out into the garden. So the first thing that you need to do is you need to catch this little chap, make him sit in one place, and then teach whatever you want to teach. After that, you can teach him maths, you can teach him science or whatever you'd like to. But the first thing is make this person sit in one place, right? And that is precisely what meditation or worship is meant to do. Swami says, from the state of multi-pointedness, you have to come to the state of one-pointedness. So when in a casual state, when our mind is free, when we're doing something or when we are idle, we have these 100 million thoughts running, thoughts about our office, thoughts about our home, thoughts about our childhood, our ambitions and aspirations. So when we meditate, what we try to do is, can we, you know, push out all these thoughts and have a single pointed attention? And that is the whole idea of meditation. So it doesn't really matter whether you have a form or you have a form of light. The idea of meditation itself is to go from multi-pointedness to one-pointedness. So now the question comes, so is it a progress to go from the form to a light? From what I said, not necessarily. If mentally we think that this is better and more correct than this, so I will meditate on this, don't you think it's a decision that is coming out of reasoning alone? It's not necessarily being guided from within. If you're listening to another person and he says, doing meditation on the light is superior, and you feel because of that I should shift to a light, I don't think that would really be a sense of progress. But nevertheless, it will help you to a certain extent. I'll explain that too. Because the whole idea is to convince this mind to calm down and sit in one place, right? And the nature of this mind is it goes around looking at everybody, comparing what you have with others, seeing whether you're doing the best thing. Are you putting your best foot forward? So when your mind thinks that meditating upon the formless is superior, sometimes it could happen that it could work in your favor. Because now the mind is convinced that this is better, and probably it will take to it more easily. And you will be able to go from this multi-pointedness to one-pointedness, as Swami says. So if that happens in the process of your meditation, if you feel that now when you're thinking of God as light, I can more effortlessly go into that state of concentration, I can more effortlessly calm down and, you know, control my thoughts, well, I think it is a sign of progress. Even if you've listened to others and you've taken up to the meditation of God as light, if you're effortlessly going into that state of concentration, I think I would take it as progress. But the only thing that you need to be weary of is this comparison, saying that I am meditating on light, so this is progress. Someone else who is meditating on form is inferior to me. I think that is one thing that you just have to mentally try to avoid, because as Swami would say many times, there are many types of pride. The most dangerous is what we call spiritual pride. If you feel that this is superior than that, that is why I gave you that explanation of how even if you think of God as light, or even if you think of God as a human form, you are equally inaccurate, because God is neither that. And he can never be understood through any of these imaginations or imaginary forms that we create for him. Right? So having said that, I think I will just add a little bit of pitch for meditating on the form aspect itself. Right? Why do we have a form for the Lord, and why do we worship him with a form? See, as I said, when we talk of a physical form, we give an extension of a human form. We create a human form and then we make it superhuman by adding extra limbs and extra heads or whatever it is. In the same manner, when we imagine the nature of God, right, when we imagine that God has qualities, we again take the good human qualities that we are aware of and then make them infinite. How is that? We all know that compassion is a good quality. So now when we talk of God, we talk of him as Karuna Sagara, the one who has infinite compassion like the ocean. Same thing, we know that love is a very divine quality. So we say he has the love of 1,000 mothers, because I understand a mother's love, which is very pure. So now I multiply it and say that the love of 1,000 mothers is that of God. And again, now we say the various qualities. If we talk of detachment, we know that detachment is a very holy quality. Then we talk of God as Yogishwara, the one who is the master of all yogis, the detached ones. So just as we do that with form, we do that with qualities too. And why is that important? Now we think of God not only as a human form, but we think of him as a human form with compassion and love and grace and all of that, 100 million times more than you and I are capable of. So now when we start meditating on this form of God, with these qualities, what Swami had said, and I think I had spoken about this in a previous answer too, when you concentrate on such qualities on God, you will slowly start imbibing them. In fact, Swami says that even when you look at a fellow citizen, if you're looking at somebody in your office and you admire some good quality in them, Swami says you will slowly start imbibing that good quality. So when you meditate on a God who is like this, who has a form, who is very loving, who is ever ready to come and grace and all of these things, imaginary things again, because the extent of God's love, none of us can really comprehend. The extent of God's compassion, I don't think we have the ability to comprehend. But still we create this image, and when we start worshipping this form, we know that he is nirguna, right? We know that he is attributeless. But we attach attributes to him, and that is why God has also got the name Sarva Guna Sampanna, which means he is nirguna, he is attributeless, but he is also Sarva Guna Sampanna, the one who is the abode of all the good qualities. Because we attribute such qualities to him, we meditate on this form, and Swami says eventually it will start sublimating your thoughts and your actions and words, which is very much what we need to look for when we are looking at ourselves and seeing, are we progressing in our spiritual path. Now I refer back to the quote which we started with, right? In that we said that it is not about how much we talk about it, it's not about how much we read about it, it's about how much peace, love and fearlessness that we exhibit in our daily life. So if you're looking at yourself and you say that, you know, 10 years back I was meditating on Krishna, 5 years back I was meditating on Swami, and today I'm meditating on light, don't ask yourself if that is progress. Look within and ask yourself, are you more peaceful now? Are you more forbearant now? Do you have more patience? Do you have the ability to take the ups and downs of life with equanimity? Has those abilities improved? If they have improved, then it is progress. And that is why when we meditate upon God with a form and with these qualities of goodness, which he truly is beyond. Swami would say that God is beyond even good and evil. But we still attribute these qualities of goodness, because we then slowly start imbibing these qualities, because that is one of the primary motives of any form of worship, what we call upasana, right? Swami would say all forms of sadhana and worship are meant for chitta shuddhi, to purify your inner impulses. So the best way to look at ourselves and see, are we progressing, is to see these things. And I had mentioned this before in one of the interviews, when one of the students asked Swami this question, that Swami, how do we know that we are progressing? We are attending bhajans every day, we are doing meditation and all of this. How do we know that we are progressing? And Swami told that, are you able to love more people every passing day? Then you are progressing. So that is the only way we can judge our progress, not whether what is the form that appears in front of me. In fact, you would be interested to know that I've spoken to some people in the ashram who say, who've been here for 30 years, 40 years, who have seen Swami, who have, you know, would rush every day for darshan, but they would say that when they close their eyes and meditate, they don't see the form of Swami, but they actually see a form of light. And it is not that that form of light is any different from Swami, but it's just that when they close their eyes, the form that comes to their mind is that of light. It could just be purely the upbringing. It could just be purely, you know, what they've read when they were young, which has stuck to their mind. It doesn't matter. But when we have had the opportunity of seeing Swami, an avatar comes down, and we've had the opportunity to interact with him, Swami says it is so much more easier for you to sit down and think of Swami. Swami would say that some of the boys would go for vacation, and when they would say that, Swami, we'll be missing your darshan, we'll be missing the bhajan session, Swami would say, no, wherever you are, close your eyes and just recreate that whole scene of darshan as you've seen it. And that is the best form of meditation, Swami would say. Because you are sitting there and you are reliving this form that you've already seen, you're putting it in your mind. Automatically, when you bring it in your mind, these qualities of love and compassion which we associate with Swami comes to our mind. The more we think of these qualities, as I said, you start imbibing them. So that is the point, that is from the point of view of worship. Don't ask yourself, am I progressing because I'm now thinking of light? Or now I'm thinking of light, which means I am falling in my spiritual progress. Don't think of it that way. That is not how it needs to be looked at. Extremely sorry about that outage, dear listeners. We just lost our connection to our server. And even now I'm just recording the part, so I think only those who are downloading this file will be able to listen to it. I'm really sorry about that. We're trying to sort it out. Hopefully we'll get that right before the other programs begin. I'll continue with the answer. I thought I'll just complete this answer. We were exactly somewhere midway, because I spoke about how we need to see our form of worship of God, and how do we see that if we are progressing or not. Is it important to worship God as a light or as a human form or whatever it is? But now coming back to the point of what is the nature of God, because that was the question the listener asked about, where she had a discussion with some people in a study group who told her that anybody with a form cannot be divinity. It can only be either a guru or a mahapurusha. It cannot be God, because God is formless and he's a form of light. Well, to understand this, we need to go back to some of the basics which Swami speaks about. One thing is, Swami says, I am God, but so are all of you. So in that sense, even though we all have a form, Swami tried to remind us again and again that, look, you are as divine as I am. So is it mandatory that to be divine you should be absolutely without form? It is not really, but at the same time, the form can never be equivalent to divinity. As we said about even our own perceptions, same can be said even about our understanding of God itself, isn't it? But to understand this, we probably have to go back to what is the human nature itself, and how is it different from the divine nature, especially when the divine comes in the form of an avatar. Swami speaks about this concept of three bodies. Swami says that all of you are not one but three. You have three bodies put together is the human experience. And those are, Swami says, the sthula sharira, the sukshma sharira, and the karana sharira. The sthula sharira is the gross body, is the body that you and I see. It's made of flesh, bones, and the tissues, the blood, the mucus, and all of that. The physical body is called the sthula sharira, or the gross body. And then comes the sukshma sharira, or the subtle body, which is a very interesting concept by itself, because the nature of the subtle body is different in different states of existence, as in being awake, being asleep and dreaming, and being in deep sleep. How is that? Swami says, when we are awake, all of our emotions, all of our thoughts, all of our aspirations, that which animate this body literally. The sukshma sharira or the subtle body expresses itself through this physical body. So all of these emotions and thoughts and fears and likes and dislikes, all of these thoughts together form the sukshma sharira, which is in the waking state. But the deeper sense of this subtle body is, Swami says, when you go to sleep, this sukshma sharira withdraws from the physical body. The subtle body withdraws from the physical body and now goes into what we call the dream state, or swapnavastha as it's called in Sanskrit. And in this state, the sukshma sharira has the ability to create a world of its own. As we all have seen in our dreams, we travel distant, different lands, we meet people we've never met, we speak languages we've never spoken. So Swami says that this sukshma sharira, once it withdraws from this physical body, now creates a world of its own and it goes through the experience of the dream state, right? That is what is the nature of the sukshma sharira, which is in the waking state it has a certain form, in the sleep state when it withdraws from the physical body, and in the dream state it has a different form. And as we will see, when the body dies, it has a different role altogether. And now coming to the third body, which is the karana sharira, which Swami says is what you really are, which we call the soul, the atman, which is absolutely detached. It does not want to indulge. It does not want to run away from anything. It does not have likes and dislikes. It does not have fear. Essentially, the divine element within us. So Swami says that when you are awake, you are completely conscious in this physical body. That is, the sukshma sharira animates this sthula sharira or the physical gross body. When you go to sleep, this subtle body withdraws from this physical body, and in this dream state it goes through all of this. And then when you go into this deep sleep state, Swami says even the subtle body is withdrawn into what we call this causal body or the Atman. So in that deep sleep state, Swami says that you all experience what it is to be divine, because your mind is completely withdrawn, and that is why that so much of importance is given to that deep sleep state, or what we call in Sanskrit as sushupti. But the thing with sleep and everyday activity is, this whole process gets reversed every morning, right? As we wake up, Swami says, the subtle body is released from this karana sharira, and it comes to that state where you're not completely awake, you're not in deep sleep, in that middle place. And then slowly when you wake up, the sukshma sharira again fills this physical body and you go about with activity. And this happens every day. And interestingly, what happens when we die, when the body is discarded, is very similar to this, but it becomes an irreversible process. So when a person dies, Swami says, first thing is, the sukshma sharira is withdrawn from the body, and since this sukshma sharira is not going to go into that body again, the body is allowed to rot. In other words, when we go to sleep, Vedanta says that the sukshma sharira is withdrawn, but it leaves one aspect of it in the body, which we call the pranas, the five pranas or the life principles, which keep the body alive. It does not allow the body to decay. But when we die, the sukshma sharira completely withdraws. It withdraws even these pranas back into itself, and the body is allowed to decay, right? And in this state, after our death, Swami says, just like how when you're asleep, the subtle body creates a dream-like experience, when you die, now the subtle body goes into heaven or hell as it sees its rightful entry into, right? The experience of heaven or hell happens through the subtle body when the body is discarded. But Swami says, even that, after a period when that your karma has been done with, now you're withdrawn into the karana sharira, which means for a few minutes, for a few moments or a long time, whatever it is, as each individual case may be, this subtle body gets withdrawn into the karana sharira, where you become one with the divine self, and there is absolutely no reason for you. There are no cravings, there are no sufferings, there are no enjoyments, right? This is the state where you are in your reality. But just like how it happened when we were sleeping and waking up, now the whole process happens where the subtle body now does not wake up into the same body, but it wakes up into a different body based on its karmic balance. The reason why the subtle body wakes up into the physical body when we are alive is because we still have karmic connections to that body that we are in, we are indwellers of. When we go into another body, when we die and are born in another body, it's the same karmic consequences which propels us to go and hold on to another body, to enter another body and then continue this journey. So Swami says, this is the nature of every human being. This is the process that happens to each one of us. We have these three bodies of Karana Sharira, the causal body, the Sukshma Sharira, the subtle body, and the Stula Sharira, which is the gross body, right? And what propels us to every time wake up into the body in the morning or wake up into a new body after we are dead, it is because of these karmic consequences, which are nothing but extensions of our desires. We want to achieve something, we want to do something, and what we have been doing propelled by this desire forms consequences, and that is what makes us be born again and again. That's in short. Now what happens when we talk about an avatar? Swami says that there is a fourth body which encompasses all of this and all of creation, and that is referred to as in Vedanta as Mahakarana Sharira. Karana Sharira is your and my reality or the Atman. The Mahakarana Sharira is that supreme oversoul which encompasses everything. And that is what we refer to as God. When you said that God does not have a form, God is beyond all of this, God is a form of light, whatever it is said, it is true, and it refers to this Mahakarana Sharira. But Swami goes on to say that this Mahakarana also wishes to incarnate once in a while. And why does that happen? Why does he want to incarnate? Why does this entity wish to incarnate? Swami says, as explained by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, he does not have any karmic consequences like you and me. It is not karma which wants him to take another body. He says, paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chatushkritam dharma samstapa narthaya sambhavam yuge yuge. Artha means a craving, a desire. So Krishna says that these are the cravings which make me come into a human form. The desire to come and foster goodness. The desire to come and bless those devotees who have been worshipping me all these while. So Swami says it is that pure intention of love which makes God incarnate in a human body. And Swami would very beautifully say in one of his Telugu Padyams, he say, avatarinchita yanatalo arthamemi. What is the meaning of saying that an avatar has taken birth? And Swami says it is that janulapai priti vatsalya paratatoda vari stai ki bhuvipai vachi daiva pragnato patuka jiva pragna. That is what the Telugu poem which Swami would say. He says out of priti and vatsalya, out of affection and motherly love, the Lord enters a human body, enters the human plane. And how does he enter? Swami says daiva pragnato batuka jiva pragna, along with the divine intelligence and the human intelligence, which is the apparent human intelligence which we call as maya, God comes in a human form. So Swami says the whole idea is that God comes with this absolutely motherly instinct, the desire to come and foster his children. And that is the only intention with which this body is taken. And Swami says that even though the God himself comes into the human form, it still is a human form, it still is a gross form. So it also has to follow the rules of time and space. It undergoes change, it undergoes decay, as we all have seen Swami himself, the body which we so much loved also undergo decay and eventually, you know, leave our midst. So Swami says that even though the God himself, the Mahakarana himself, comes with a Sukshma Sharira and a Stula Sharira, even that is subject to change. But the only thing is, because the intention of descent is so pure, Swami says the avatar's body is not as mrinmaya as a human body, is not as ephemeral and dust-like like a human body, but it is chinmaya, it is superior, it is very supreme, it is filled with consciousness. And Swami says that is why there is a lot of benefit in looking at a human body which has come in the form of an incarnation, meditating on that, thinking of that, having the darshan of that form is so very precious, they say. To be touched by that form is so very precious, they say. To even sit in meditation and think of that form is so precious. So that is why God comes in the human form. I completely understand that you go into a study circle and people say this and you listen to that, but you know, the reason why I quoted this example of the three bodies and what happens when an incarnation comes, this is consistently spoken of in the Vedas, in the Vedanta. Krishna speaks about in the Bhagavad Gita. It is spoken of in the Bhagavatam, and very, very clearly and beautifully explained by Swami many, many times during the many discourses that he has given. I spoke about pramanas. I spoke about two pramanas that we have, which is pratyaksha pramana, direct perception, is a tool of knowledge. Our ability to infer and come to conclusions is a tool of knowledge. The Vedanta speaks of a third form of pramana, which is called shabda pramana. It says that you may not be able to come to the conclusion yourself, you may not be able to perceive yourself, but someone who has had the ability or had the vision of the divine comes and tells you that this is what happens. Swami says that is a third tool of knowledge, and sometimes that would be the most effective. And they often say that the Vedas, the Vedantas, and the words of the Gurus and Mahapurushas are that Shabda Pramana which we have, right? So when we are trying to understand God, whom we'll never be able to understand, here are a group of individuals who say that this is what is God's form. But here is Vedas and Vedantas, which are supposed to be Shrutis, which are supposed to be the voice of the Lord, and we have the Lord Himself speaking, right? And He is explaining things to us. So I think it's up to us whom we really believe in, whose words we will take to more into consideration. Will we take into consideration the words of those people who are still exploring the nature of God? Or will we take into consideration the words of those people who have nothing to gain from you believing or not believing, who purely have, as Swami said, when God comes in the form of an incarnation, there is only one pure motive, and the motive is to help you in your progress, is to help you go within. And He gives these explanations. I think the question is, the Shabda Pramana which we take, whose are we going to take? Are we going to take the words of a few individuals coming together and trying to understand God, or are we going to take the words of God and the godly themselves? To sum it all up, I would only say, you know, these are two different aspects. You know more and more about God, you can become a jnani. But if you want to become a devotee, if you want to become a bhakta, you need to love God more and more. You have to increase your faith, right? So decide which is the path that you wish to be in. To try to understand God is also a path. We call it Jnana Marga. You constantly try to understand Him better and better and finally reach Him. The Bhakti Marga is a different path where you try to purify yourself, you try to increase your love, you try to fortify your faith. That's a different path. So you can choose which one you have, but in both cases, the sign of progress is not what is the vision that you have in your mind. The sign of progress is yourself. As we started off with that quote, are you becoming more peaceful? Are you becoming more loving? Are you becoming more fearless? Right? And there will be more and more clarity coming as you progress. So if you feel comfortable meditating upon light, you should do that. In fact, that is what is helping you. If that is helping you concentrate more, I think you should do that. You are not wrong in doing that. But only thing is, it is not that anybody who is meditating on the form is any way inferior, or you are higher in your progress or lower in your progress compared to that. Because be it a form of a human being, be it a form of light, or be it a form of emptiness, all of these are equally inaccurate when we try to define God, because God is aprameya, beyond our tools of knowledge. I hope I've answered your question. Once again, very sorry for that interruption that we had in between. I'm sure only those who have downloaded the file are going to listen to this part of the answer. So I once again apologize for that. And if you have any further questions on what I've said, you can always write back to me at prem@radiosai.org. So that, dear listeners, was the answer for today's question. Of course, I did want to share something else, but thanks to their interruption in between, it took a lot of our time away. So we'll have it for another day. You know, I'm going nowhere, the radio is going nowhere, and you're all going nowhere. So I can share it with you on another day. I'm going to leave you with one of the most classic and beautiful bhajans ever sung by Swami. I remember listening to this bhajan when I was a student at Swami's college in Vrindavan. I was a young student in the undergrad, and I recall how fascinated the entire class was when we heard this bhajan for the first time in Swami's voice. It is so beautiful, it is so loving, the way Swami sings, and I'm sure you all would have heard it, and if you've not heard it, be prepared to fall in love. So dear listeners, thank you for joining me. If you have a question on practical spirituality, you know, be sure to send it to me. I'll be glad to answer it. Naming you or not naming you like today, you can send your queries to prem@radiosai.org, prem@radiosai.org, which is my personal ID. So the mails that you send to me will not be read by anybody else. Confidentiality is guaranteed. So if you have a question, do send it to me. I'll join you again next week for the next episode of the Radio Sai Answering Booth. But in about half an hour's time, I'll be back with you for the next episode of Afternoon Satsang. So now I'm leaving you with that bhajan, the beautiful bhajan in Swami's own voice.
Narayana bhajan Narayan, Narayana bhajan Narayan, Narayan,
Narayana bhajan Narayan.
Narayana bhajan Narayan, Narayana bhajan Narayan, Narayan,
Narayana bhajan Narayan.
ಮನರಂಜನ ಭವ ಭಯ ಬಂಧನ ಅಸುರ ನಿಖಂಡನ ನಾರಾಯಣ
ಮನರಂಜನ ಭವ ಭಯ ಬಂಧನ ಅಸುರ ನಿಖಂಡನ
ಹನುಮನರಂಜನ ಭವ ಭಯ ಭಂಜನ ಅಸುರ ನಿಖಂಡನ ನಾರಾಯಣ
ಹನುಮನರಂಜನ ಭವ ಭಯ ಭಂಜನ ಅಸುರ ನಿಖಂಡನ ನಾರಾಯಣ
ನಾರಾಯಣ ಭಜ ನಾರಾಯಣ ನಾರಾಯಣ ಭಜ ನಾರಾಯಣ ನಾರಾಯಣ
ನಾರಾಯಣ ಭಜ ನಾರಾಯಣ
ಜಗು ಜಗು ಪೀಡಾ ಪಡೆ ಭಕ್ತ ಪರ ಬಾರ ಬಾರ ಅವತಾರ ಕಿಯಾ
ಜಗು ಪೀಡಾ ಪಡೆ ಭಕ್ತ ಪರ ಬಾರ ಬಾರ ಅವತಾರ ಕಿಯಾ
ಪಾಪ ಮಿಟಾ ಕರ ಧೀರ ದಿಖಾ ಕರ ಮಾನವ ಕೋ ಉದಾರ ಕಿಯಾ
ಪಾಪ ಮಿಟಾ ಕರ ಧೀರ ದಿಖಾ ಕರ ಮಾನವ ಕೋ ಉದಾರ ಕಿಯಾ
ಪಾಪ ಮಿಟಾ ಕರ ಧೀರ ದಿಖಾ ಕರ ಮಾನವ ಕೋ ಉದಾರ ಕಿಯಾ
ಪಾಪ ಮಿಟಾ ಕರ ಧೀರ ದಿಖಾ ಕರ ಮಾನವ ಕೋ ಉದಾರ ಕಿಯಾ
ವಿಹಾರಿ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಮುರಾರಿ ಹೇ ಗಿರಿಧಾರಿ ನಾರಾಯಣ
ವಿಹಾರಿ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಮುರಾರಿ ಹೇ ಗಿರಿಧಾರಿ ನಾರಾಯಣ
ಕುಂಜ ವಿಹಾರಿ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಮುರಾರಿ ಹೇ ಗಿರಿಧಾರಿ ನಾರಾಯಣ
ಕುಂಜ ವಿಹಾರಿ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಮುರಾರಿ ಹೇ ಗಿರಿಧಾರಿ
ನಾರಾಯಣ ಭಜ ನಾರಾಯಣ ನಾರಾಯಣ ಭಜ ನಾರಾಯಣ ನಾರಾಯಣ
ನಾರಾಯಣ ಭಜ ನಾರಾಯಣ ನಾರಾಯಣ ಭಜ ನಾರಾಯಣ
ನಾರಾಯಣ ಮತ್ಸ್ಯಕೂರ್ಮ ವರಾಹ ನರಹರಿ ವಮನ ಕೋ ಅವತಾರ ಕಿಯಾ ಪರಶುರಾಮ ಅವರು ರಾಮ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಬನ ಪರಶುರಾಮ ಅವರು ರಾಮ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ದುಷ್ಟೋ ಸಂಹಾರ ಕಿಯಾ
ದುಷ್ಟೋ ಸಂಹಾರ ಕಿಯಾ
ಹೇ ಅವತಾರಿ ಲೀಲಾಧಾರಿ ಕುಂಜ ವಿಹಾರಿ ನಾರಾಯಣ
ಹೇ ಅವತಾರಿ ಲೀಲಾಧಾರಿ ಕುಂಜ ವಿಹಾರಿ ನಾರಾಯಣ
Narayana bhaja Narayana, Narayana bhaja Narayana, Narayana. भजन से मन को सजन बनाकर भक्ति मार्ग सिखला दिया भजन से मन को सजन बनाकर भक्ति मार्ग सिखला दिया साई भजन से भव सागर को पार नबी सिखला दिया साई भजन से पतितो धारी पति विहारी हे गिरिधारी नारायण
पतितो धारी पति विहारी हे गिरिधारी नारायण
पतितो धारी पति विहारी साई मुरारी नारायण
पतितो धारी पति विहारी साई मुरारी
Narayana bhaja Narayana, Narayana bhaja Narayana, Narayana.
Narayana bhaja Narayana, Narayana bhaja Narayana, Narayana.
Narayana bhaja Narayana, Narayana bhaja Narayana, Narayana.
Narayana bhaja Narayana, Narayana bhaja Narayana.
Narayan, 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 Narayan.